Hey, what's going on? Welcome to the Mile High Five podcast. I'm Doug Cunnington and Dusty Young is joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
Doing awesome. And today we are doing mailbag and Facebook group questions. We're going to talk about the psychology of dealing with high expenses that are sort of surprises, even when you can afford it. We also have a question from Angela about filling a 10-year gap of expenses when you're Coastfi. We also have a question from Rakesh about if we would rather inherit a $500,000 index fund or a $500,000 rental home property that's producing income. So kind of a fun hypothetical question. And yeah, I think we could just jump into it. I will let people know we have the Facebook group and Carl was heading that up before, and I'm still in the process of figuring out what I'm going to do. And I thought about doing maybe like a little like live stream in the Facebook group occasionally because I have all the equipment to do it. What do you think of that?
I think that's a great idea. I know we in the Econo-We section will actually post, like every week they post a question, you know, like how are you going to support women in their finances? And so just that is kind of nice, like having that weekly question that you post. And then occasionally on Tuesdays, I know we have potluck, but they actually do like a live webinar on Tuesdays, which is pretty amazing.
Interesting. I'll have to figure something out. It's always good to be consistent so people can actually show up and stuff. But then that signs me up to do a thing.
You know, there's got to be some way to automate it.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, it should be fun though. Should be fun. But if you have any ideas out there and you're in the Facebook group, let me know. And like I said, a lot of the questions did come from the Facebook group, or you could email me directly at doug@milehighfi.com. So the first one is from Sam, and I'll read this out. I'm Coastfire, currently working part-time to cover expenses without touching my portfolio. I have a net worth of just shy of $2 million with around $1.5 million in broad low-cost ETFs, and the rest is in the house and in retirement accounts. The net worth fluctuates like by a huge amount, like $1,000 to $3,000 per day, or sometimes with high volatility, like $10,000 or $30,000. And yeah, it's dramatic, but it sounds like Sam is okay with that. Here's the dilemma. Even with a solid net worth, I still stress over expenses like a $600 home repair, higher home insurance, unexpected water bills, and anything like that. I spend time researching and finding the best deals, but I'm wondering if these minor expenses are worth worrying about when you compare it to my overall financial picture. So should I let the guilt go and focus on the long-term goal? I want to highlight a couple different responses, or at least one from Chris in the Facebook group said, $600 out of your net worth is only 0.03%. I would personally not lose any sleep over such a small purchase, expected or unexpected. So Dusty, as someone who is recently retired, what do you think of that?
I think it's hard to reset your perspective. And most of us in this category have spent a long time doing exactly what you're doing, analyzing every decision that we're making, thinking about every dollar, wanting to make sure that you're getting the most out of the money that you're spending, wanting to feel like you're spending money wisely. And I like this perspective. When you think about all of what you've done to get to this point, 0.03%, is it really going to matter in the grand scheme of things? Or is your time more valuable? And what would need to be true for you to let go of this guilt? Like for you to let go of this guilt, what would need to be true? And if you were giving advice to someone else, what would be the advice that you would give them? Because we can say, like Doug and I can sit here and say, oh, think about your time. What could you be doing with that time? Does it really matter in the grand scheme of things that you saved $100, but you spent 2 hours researching and asking questions? Is it worth it to pay more to get quality work? I've been having that debate in my own head a lot lately where I would rather pay someone what they're worth, feel good about the money that I spent versus nickel and diming someone or looking for the cheapest person. I want to pay someone what they're worth. I want them to know that their work is appreciated and encourage them to be on this path. So I think thinking about things differently, thinking about how you're paying it forward, thinking about how you're fueling this economy with paying somebody what they are worth so that they're not going and doing a different occupation or trying to, you know, like hurry up on the job and maybe not do as great of a job because they don't feel like they're being paid fairly. You know, all of those things, I think, kind of come into play when I'm thinking about this question. What do you think, Doug?
Yeah, I think one other portion I'll add in here. Sam has budgeted for these unexpected events. So he has an emergency fund. He has some other stuff. And that was in some follow-up comments. So basically, like, it's $600 and it's a lot. However, it's already covered. Like, he's allotted that. And the thing is, when I first started reading the overall message, it's just like, oh, wow. Like, I mean, you have to account for that. So like, we live in a new home, but we still budget for, what is it, like 1% per the amount of the home value. So we still budget for that, but it's really unlikely in the first 10 years that we're going to have to do some sort of major repair that's like, you know, $20,000 or something like that, like a roof. Pretty unlikely, but if something did happen, it would probably be the roof from like hail damage. So the point is, like, you should budget for it. But if you've budgeted for it and then you have your projection, then it's just like, this is part of the cash flow that we expected. So just pay it and move on. Now, to your point here about spending time researching and finding the best deal, or even worse, a lot of us were brought up, do the work that you can do. If you can do it, do it. Don't pay someone else to do it. And it, I mean, sometimes it doesn't make sense, right? Like, there's some things I probably could do, but I would have to buy like four new pieces of equipment to do it. Or like you just said, like, people have jobs and it's great if we can hire a local handy person to do that work instead of like me doing that or trying to do it.
And you're helping them support their family and their craft and their occupation. I think all of those things are really valuable, where sometimes we try to do the work ourselves, and it's something that we might want to learn. And it's okay to hire someone too and ask if you can shadow them. Mm-hmm. You know, like, hey, this is really interesting. Could I help you with it? Could I do it with you? And I don't know that that comes with a discount, because some people think that that automatically comes with a discount. And I wouldn't say that that is always the case. I would say sometimes you're slowing down this expert.
They should charge more.
Yeah, exactly. Because they are teaching you. And that, I don't know, to me, it just really feels like a gift that we can support people. Mm-hmm.
Last thing I'll say on this one is, there's a phrase in here. I spend time researching and finding the best deal. So another issue with a lot of the fire people, which I don't have, is they're maximizers, they're optimizers. And you're like, I want to get the best deal. But I am a satisficer. Are you familiar with that term?
Yeah,
right?
We talked about that before. I like that. But people might not know what a satisficer is. So maybe you could explain.
Basically, I look for any solution that meets the minimum requirements, maybe a little bit more, but basically I'm just like, if this solution works, I will go forward with that. And it's a huge percentage, like 99% of the time, it is fine. And it's not like you're getting any bigger benefit by getting like the best deal, especially if you're like an oversaver, like many of us are, because we like over-optimized, we maximized everything up until this point, it's hard to let that go. And a lot of us, like, I actually have an engineering degree, and some time ago, I was just like, I let go of some of the engineering, like, optimization and maximization. In a lot of ways, it's a huge waste of time, and it like stresses you out. So this is like the main issue that Elizabeth and I have, because she's a maximizer over and over again. And it works out well a lot. But if you read Paradox of Choice by Barry Schwartz, satisficers are happier. So I'm sticking with mine. But anyway, usually you don't have to find the best deal. Find one that works. And maybe you're paying more, but maybe you're actually getting like a better deal in the long run because you spend less time on it. And maybe they're doing a better job.
And I think to that point about how do you let go of the guilt, or how do you reframe your thinking, I said this in a previous podcast that I was on with Doug. I go back to the idea of journaling. And to me, like keeping that record of how much time you spent researching something and what the outcome was, it might help you recognize these patterns so that you can let go of the guilt and so you can feel good about being a satisficer or feel good about, oh, you know, I had this money set aside. That $100 in the grand scheme of things is really not making any difference in my projections. So I think writing things down and keeping track of them will help you let go of that guilt. I don't know that for sure, but I would say to, you know, maybe try that out, Sam, and see if it's helpful.
I think with the guilt, I guess it depends on the source. Great solution, Dusty, but I was going to say, if someone feels guilty because they're like wasting money in like in air quotes, I think we need to remember there's always waste. You're buying sort of freedom of like the stress. So it's like, if I could buy my way by paying like whatever, $700 instead of $600 to get rid of that stress, like that's so worth it. $100.
This point that Doug is making is amazing, which is why you need to write it down, because I think our memories are like, oh, but I did it myself and I saved $100 versus, you know, like exactly what Doug is saying, where no, that's not actually the case. Like, I didn't make the right decision, but in my memory, I think that I did because everything turned out fine. So I keep doing that.
Yeah.
Where when you kind of keep track of these patterns, then you can have that aha moment where you're like, oh yeah, duh. Like, I keep telling myself this. So what is the source of my guilt and how do I let go of that source? And what's the evidence to support that? Because I think a lot of us are evidence-based. Mm-hmm. And having that written record is really helpful because everything you're saying is right. But ask me in 6 months and I might be like, oh no, everything worked out fine.
It was perfect.
I can do this remodel again myself.
All right. Well, thanks for the question, Sam. And hopefully we gave you a little permission to, you know, waste some money out there. That's all right. Sometimes we waste money. Okay. Before we move on to the next question from Angela, we have a sponsor, Ghostbed, and they've been working with us for a little while. I recently got the queen mattress. It's a luxe. Ooh. Very, very comfortable. It has sort of the maximum cooling potential for their cooling technology. I think they have patents on it. It's very good. Now,
sounds nice and soft.
Yeah.
Very luxurious.
It's like sleeping on clouds, I think. They have several different mattresses, by the way. And if you're unsure which one might work best for you, you can take their sleep quiz and it'll ask you some questions. But the thing is, you don't have to worry too much because there's a 101-night at-home sleep trial and you can test it out. And I think 101 is more than enough days to test it out. When we were in Leadville, right? So in a previous show, we talked about Dusty, you came to Leadville to hang out when Elizabeth and I were out there. The beds were not that great. And I slept so poorly. And the thing is, like, if you get an Airbnb, like, you don't expect to have like the very best mattress. But like, have you been to an Airbnb where you were like, this is sort of a luxury, like, this feels good. The pillows are nice instead of like the paper thin ones.
Yeah, I have definitely stayed at Airbnbs where I thought, oh, this is amazing. What kind of mattress is this? And you're like trying to lift up the cover so you can see. And then I have been at ones where I'm like, I need to see what this is because I don't want this ever.
And I wonder, like, if you... Because you have a couple Airbnbs, right? Yeah. So like, do you play up your, if you're like, hey, we have like good pillow, like we have high quality, like sleeping stuff. Like, I think that would go a long way after we've had a few poor experiences.
In one, we list that it has an avocado mattress.
Okay. That's it.
Is that because avocado is supposed to be super comfy and it's also free of all the chemicals and, you know, it's like a very clean mattress where you're not worried about the toxins that are getting into your skin. So
gotcha.
We definitely play that up.
All right. And I think it makes such a big difference because basically like I slept fucking terrible there and it was a little bit rough, even though it was a cool environment. I mean, we had the windows out. It was cold in there. It was like 62 degrees.
I mean, the Airbnb was beautiful. Like it was very well decorated. It had all the linens, but if they had a ghost bed, So maybe if you just sent them the link and let them know that they could get a 50% discount.
They can. You can save 50% if you go to ghostbed.com/milehighfi, or you could use milehighfi at checkout. And they have a full range of stuff. So not just mattresses. They have like sheets and pillows and the bed sets. What do you call those? Frames?
Oh, they have bed frames too?
They do. I think
so. That is amazing. I now need to go to ghostbed.com. You really should. This Airbnb was... It was so cute. Like, I thought they did a wonderful job, but they could definitely benefit from Ghostbed.
Yeah. I don't know what they got.
Both mattresses were a little rough.
So thanks a lot to Ghostbed. And this question is from Angela. So they're getting close to Coast Fi. They need about 10 years worth of money to fill the gap until they hit 60, when they can access their retirement funds, basically. So they gave a couple different options that they're thinking about. This is A, slow down our contributions to our 401k so that we get the company match and then redirect the other funds to an after-tax brokerage account, which they would pay more in taxes, obviously. Or B, continue with what they're doing and keep maxing out 401ks with leftovers going into a brokerage account, buffer a high yield savings account or CD ladder for 5 years and just plan on doing Roth conversions for the first 5 years so we can access the money for the other 5 years, or see some other idea. So there were a few suggestions in Facebook, and I'll mention Stephanie says there are several ways to access money from 401ks to avoid penalties. 72Ts don't require waiting 5 years to get access, and people should do further research beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today. Matthew,
I would say, like, if you're interested in the 72T option, there are a lot of podcast episodes with Eric Cooper, our friend who has done 72Ts. And by no means are we saying, oh, this is an expert, go talk to this person. What we are saying is, if you're curious, you want to learn more, that would be a great way to get your feet wet and to learn more.
Darren and Jolene also went the 72T route for at least a portion. And yeah, so we know people that have done this. Next is from Matthew, says, we went with option A, but due to job burnout and they wanted a change. So option B seems less risky, but having the cash and the bridge buffer account was attractive for us. So, Dusty, what do you think? This is not financial advice, everybody, but what do you think?
I mean, I would agree. Option A is a little bit riskier, but it gives you more flexibility. And so if you are looking to get out earlier, you might want to go with option A. You could look at option B. I think, you know, you could also just do the best of both worlds, right? Try some type of hybrid approach. Look for more liquidity, look for some tax efficiencies. You know, I don't think that you're, I guess I think and is a really great word here, where you don't have to choose one or the other. You could do one and the other. What do you think?
I think I would go with option A. That's literally what we did. And then at some point stopped contributing to any pre-tax retirement accounts. A lot of people don't like that, but you have full flexibility if you put it into your post-tax brokerage account. You don't get the tax benefits. But one thing with our optimization and our, you know, DeFi community is, like, people fucking hate paying taxes, right? We all hate paying taxes. I don't mind paying taxes. People, like, you get a lot of benefit from paying taxes, and it's something we have to struggle with. But, like, everyone's like, yeah, you know what? I'm not paying any taxes. Like, you're probably getting some benefit, and I'm not judging anyone, but go ahead.
I said this in the last question. Like, yeah. I like paying people what they are worth. So yeah. I like being able to compensate someone for the work that they are doing and to do that fairly and to pay them adequately. That feels really good to me. And I feel the same way about taxes, where, I mean, maybe I'm not the norm. I take advantage of all of the fairs and the festivals and the events that Longmont puts on. And I think Longmont does a wonderful job. And I enjoy the flowers that they put out. And I love, Like, I love all of those things. So for me, paying taxes feels like a privilege because I'm supporting this community. And I don't know that I've always felt that way, because I think there were times when I was just like on the climb and trying to get to this number and trying to save a certain amount, and taxes felt like they were getting in the way. And I'd also think, well, I'm single, I don't have kids, and my sister, who has a ton of children, is getting this huge refund back. Like, why don't I just give you my money? So I've had those thoughts in the past. I'm by no means am I perfect, and I'm saying, oh yeah, I've always thought this way. I haven't always thought this way. I guess the more experience that I have in life and the more conversations that I have, the more I just feel pretty grateful that I get to pay these taxes, experience the benefits, and support this amazing community that we live in. Because if I didn't pay these taxes, we could live in a very crappy place that isn't kept up, that doesn't pay their employees well, where their employees don't want to work for the city because they're not compensated. So I know we do spend a lot of time trying to minimize the amount that we pay in taxes. And I'll also just say I'm Team Doug. Like,
okay.
I'm okay paying taxes.
Yeah, it's okay to pay taxes. The other, so I tried to sound a little righteous there, which, you know, I think it's okay to pay taxes. If people don't want to pay taxes, also cool with that. There was probably definitely a time where I would have like not paid any taxes if I could get away with it. Thing is, I'm lazy. And then like you got to figure out what to do. And it's a little more complicated if you're like trying to avoid taxes.
And sometimes I do get on that. I don't really want to pay taxes because I want my income to be as little as possible so that healthcare is cheaper.
Right.
Like, you know, could you offset my healthcare costs because I'm not making anything? And also, you guys, if you listen to previous episodes, I have always worked like very low paying jobs. So notoriously, my tax bracket has also been very low. So I probably have a different viewpoint than, you know, somebody that's being taxed very heavily or is in a higher tax bracket.
Right. Okay. So to wrap it up here, basically, I think either choice would be okay. You potentially could do a little bit of a blend. And the thing is, you can get, you know, Stephanie mentioned like there's a lot of ways to access money from your 401ks to avoid penalties. It's true. When people have explained the 72T, it does sound fairly straightforward. However, I will say, that's from people who have already figured it out. And usually when you start down one of these routes, you find that things are far more complicated than anyone actually communicated to you. They don't see it the same way anymore because now they're an expert. I'm sure it's a little bit more straightforward, but I will tell you, like, if you do the brokerage way, like, we were ignorant. We didn't know we could do other stuff. This was like a decade ago. And I was like, you know what? We need to stop putting money in. We looked at it, we agreed, and we started putting money into our post-tax. And it gives us full flexibility to do whatever the fuck we want, whenever we want. And we had no issues like bridging any sort of gap or anything. It was just like, you're set. You can do whatever you want. So it makes it much easier that way.
In hindsight, would you do it the same way again?
Yeah, I think so. There's one aspect where I haven't done the math. It turns out it probably doesn't matter that much, but the market has been up so much over the past 10 years. There's a chance that we could have put everything into pre-tax, taken the 10% penalty and been further ahead anyway, like even taking the penalty and paying taxes and doing all that shit. But it worked out fine. Like we're fine. So, but I haven't done the math.
Well, and do you ever wonder if this question is similar to the question above, where it does become like a time issue? Like, how much time are you spending going through these different scenarios when do you think you would have figured it out anyway? Like, even if there was a gap in your money, do you think you would have figured something else out?
I think so, maybe. That said, because Elizabeth is a maximizer, I mean, I think she already worked a little, don't tell her, but I think she worked too long anyway. but I think maybe she would have stuck with it even longer because there's this other little piece of uncertainty. Even if we could have done a 72T and been like, all right, we could just move this over and we'll have 80K a year or whatever. Like, I think she still would have been like, I'm not sure. So I don't know though.
Yeah. It's interesting to think about.
Okay. Next question from Rakesh. Would you rather inherit a $500 or $500,000 house with rent income or $500K in index funds? Why or why not? So what do you think, Dusty?
This, Rakesh, feels like a very complicated question. So I would need more information because I don't know that much about this $500,000 house. I don't know if there's deferred maintenance. I don't know if I'm inheriting a problem. I don't know how great or terrible the rental market is there. Like, am I going to be able to find tenants? Is it easy to find tenants? Was there a business that just closed down and now I have this problem that's going to sit and I'm going to have carrying costs? You know, like, we always want to assume the rosy side of things. I think rental income is not passive income. Like, as much as people say, oh, you just get rental income, you just collect a check every month. I have rentals. It is not passive. There is always maintenance that needs to be done. There are tenants to be screened. There are issues that come up. There is stuff. And so, yes, you might be, you might have income and that might help the person inheriting the house. If they don't know how to deal with rental income, that might become a problem. If they don't know how to hire a property manager, you know, like, is that person inheriting the house signing up for the job of real estate? Because it is a job. And if they're not, then goodness, I hope that they do not inherit this house because it's going to be a huge headache. And then they're going to figure out how to get rid of it. And what a nightmare. But if they're excited about it and it offers, you know, more, right, like rental income offers flexibility. So when I think about the question above, like, what would you do? For me, having that rental income solves that gap problem where I have income coming in and I don't have to touch my investment accounts because I have this and I don't have to think about the 72T or try to like figure out all these ladderings. Like, it's pretty simple, pretty straightforward. I have this money. That's what I live on, unless I have like a very prolonged vacancy or I have like a huge repair or something out of the ordinary comes up that I don't have the reserves to cover. I have income. Great. This is what I signed up for. I knew what I was getting into. I don't know that everybody knows that. And I also think like with the, you know, if you inherit $500,000 and it's in an investment account and the market is like it's been the last 10 years, you have this money. And your life essentially has changed in the long run, but you continue working and you now just have this cushion that's growing and growing and growing and is going to likely allow you to retire sooner. So I think that, yeah, I didn't realize I had so many opinions about it. And then I was reading your question, Rakesh, and I asked my friend what he would do. And he said, well, how much is the income? And I was like, well, what percentage would you need it to be to make it worth your time? And he's like, I think the 1% rule is fine. And I just like, I was like, no, no, that's not enough. That's not it. Like, are you going to hire a property manager? Are you going to screen tenants? Are you going to like deal with the maintenance? So,
yeah,
I mean, I just like, and James is very pro investment accounts. So for him to even consider it, obviously, like, it's a great option. I just would want someone to be prepared for what they're getting and to know that that inheritance is coming in that form. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, I think it could maybe blindside you. Sorry, I'll stop ranting.
No, that's good. That's good. It's funny. Yeah, I read it and I was like, oh, this is pretty simple, straightforward. For me personally, totally the index funds. And I think, you know, one way people could look at this, right? I agree with all that you said. And if people have listened to the show, I'm not a real estate person. I don't want to deal with the stuff that you mentioned. And basically, you could look at the rental income versus what you would expect for the returns. And then, I mean, you would have to get a decent chunk of money to make it worthwhile to like get the house instead of the index fund. Now, if you wanted, you know, the rental home and you were like, oh, I want to have this income.
Sign me up for this job.
Then that's great. But yeah, and the thing is like, I mean, real estate is one of those industries, especially like it's similar to the make money online industry, which I was in, but it's like people are like, oh yeah, you get rich in real estate and like use other people's money, all this stuff. It's a big industry of like education and selling courses or selling access and all this stuff. So really real estate is as scammy as make money online, maybe more because people are happy to pay whatever tens of thousands of dollars for these mastermind groups and such. Mm-hmm. Cause they exist, right?
Like 100%. Like they are everywhere. And I think they are selling you something that is valuable if you take action and you learn the information and you execute on it. And also, it will never prepare you for everything that you will actually experience, unless you are just super lucky and everything is smooth and no problems. But I know, like, I started in real estate and I used other people's money because I was working, you know, just like I was working a 40-hour-a-week job, salary job. It wasn't a high-paying job. It was doing stuff that I love and financial wellness that I would do again. And being able to borrow money at a low interest rate, have the rental income to then build up enough savings to get my next rental to then like keep doing that process, incredibly valuable for me. I didn't have someone saying, here's $500,000 at, you know, who knows how old this person is. Like for me, inheriting $500,000 at, you know, my 40s is still incredibly valuable. I'm going to have tons of time for that to double and have more than enough. If I was 18, man, like you're going to be just fine. You don't need this headache and you don't need to learn all these things. It might actually free up your mind space where I can learn guitar. I can like dive into homebrewing. I can, you know, like learn how to cook and do these things that I enjoy. And not that people enjoy working on houses and people enjoy figuring those things out. There's nothing wrong with that. Like I enjoy pieces of that. Would I have done something different if that opportunity had been available? Maybe, you know, and in hindsight, like I do hope someone is listening to this and, you know, like if my nephews are listening, they might say, do not leave me that house. Like, please sell it before, you know, like, cause I mean, I have five nephews and I'm not sure that any of them would be excited about being a landlord or working with property managers or... I mean, I don't love working with property managers.
I was
going to
say, do you like it even? Yeah, you picked it. Yeah, and the thing is, yeah, it's a slam dunk for me, like index fund all the way. Yeah.
Yeah.
Even if the returns are worse, it's like, I just don't want to do that kind of work. So how many rental properties do you have?
Three.
If you could get... Like, would you sell them if you could get a good amount and just be like, you know what? I could just put it all into an index fund. Have you looked at the numbers now these days?
I have. And it is certainly part of my plan is to sell them at some point. I don't think that I will be a forever hold investor. The income is helpful and it's bridging this gap and it is allowing me to not work right now, like to not actively pursue a full-time job, which I love. And it's been very fun to like play and to kind of figure out what I want to do. But a lot of people are like buy and hold and they want to have that property forever. I don't know that that's where I'm at, you know, like where when I think about what I want to do with my time, the things that come up and the things that you deal with as a landlord, when I was in Michigan and I was closer to my properties, it was much easier to screen people and to kind of get a feel of, do I want them to live in my property? Are they taking care of it? It was easier to do drive-bys. I've struggled to hire property management companies where I am excited to work with them and I trust that they are doing everything that I would do if I was, you know, boots on the ground. Mm-hmm. So long answer to your very easy question. Yes, I would consider selling them.
Gotcha. Yeah, makes sense. All right. Well, that wraps it up, I think. So, Dusty, you're on Instagram. That's the best place for people to find you, right?
Yep. Please find me and connect. It's Dustina Louise.
You told me once that you, whenever you're on the show, you get like 10 or 15 new followers over
there. It's kind of fun. That's yeah. Cool. I do get like some really great people that reach out and connect. And I love that. So send me a message. Say hi.
That's cool. I get none. No what? One follows me. Yeah. You know what? I don't put a link in there. I'll put a link this time. I'll see what happens. I'm not sure.
See how maybe I'll have a flood. Excited to meet you.
Usually it's just like food and beer. Maybe I'll do some mountain stuff. We've been traveling a little bit, so I could do that. So, all right, cool. Well, thanks. And if people have questions out there, you could drop them at the Facebook group. You can leave a comment on YouTube, or you can send me an email, doug@milehighfi.com. Thanks, Dusty. Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer. This show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. It's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. You told me that your phone stopped working. You were part of the outage recently. What happened?
So, well, first, let's just like take a step back. And a couple of weeks ago, my phone just stopped working. My beautiful iPhone, the charging port, no longer worked. So I had the same problem that Doug had. And Doug actually lent me this wireless charger so that I could rectify that, because of course my phone would stop working when I'm traveling to Salida and Leadville and all these places where I realize how navigationally inept I am. Not even challenged. I just suck. It's not even a little bit. I'm like, I don't know how to get back from Boulder. And I go to Boulder all the time and it's 20 minutes from here. But my phone had stopped working. So I was really excited because I upgraded my phone and I finally had a working phone. So this is my first trip that I was taking with a working phone. And we're looking at condos in Frisco. And I go to pull up some information. Nothing. It's stuck in SOS mode. So then I spent an hour Googling how to get my phone out of SOS mode. I reset the new phone. I reach out to Verizon. I like go through all the steps to try to figure out what's happening, only to find out that no, there's actually a Verizon outage and I was impacted. So I had no phone all day.
Oh, I was going to say, was it like freeing? But it sounded like
it was annoying.
Yeah, it was annoying for a while, I guess.
And then I just said, F it, and put my phone away and was like, well, I said to my friend, I said, okay, you're in charge of navigating us and finding information, because all I have is a very expensive, pretty teal brick.
So it wasn't freeing. You weren't like, oh, I forgot my phone and everything was great. It wasn't like that.
No, I was just like pissed and annoyed. And then I was like, okay, this just, nothing has changed. I upgraded my phone and nothing has changed. F it. I'm going to go enjoy the day.
After my port stopped working, I kept my phone and used it like that for like 5 years or something. Like it, I had it longer with the port not working than when it worked.
If I didn't suck at navigation, I would have done the same thing. But yeah, I can't even, like, I'm coming back from Leadville. My phone has died and I'm in Boulder And I go past the first, like, so I've made this trip. I made this trip so many times this summer going back and forth from Frisco. And Frisco and Leadville are close for those listening. So I've made this trip 100 times. I know what I'm doing. No, I get into Boulder and I'm like, where do I go? So then I am going like way out of my way. And then I hit Valmont and I'm like, all right, I know I turned right on Valmont. So I'm good. But I had to like go all through town, which was probably like a 10-minute delay.
Oh, right. Instead of hopping off at like Table Mesa or something.
Yeah. So if I wasn't such an idiot when it comes to directions, and then you're even more upset because you like get mad at yourself for being so dumb and not knowing this information. And then you can't even like I can't text and be like, hey, I'm on this street. And then you think, do I do the old school thing and just stop the gas station and ask?
And they're like, what are you even asking for? Well, the thing is, like, we're atrophied because I used to be better with directions. I still have a good like sort of spatial relationship. Like I understand like Flatirons are over there, like just head this direction, like you'll be all right. It can take
I have
you
that
longer.
Too, but not efficiently.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, like, I know what you're talking about because you end up driving through campus and stuff, and then it's like there's a lot more cars there and pedestrians. Our directional skills have atrophied because we have our fucking phones. So, like, if I have the opportunity, I'm like, oh, I want to drive around and kind of not get lost, but I'm just like, I'll remember it if I figure this out. But if I just like follow the
maps, if Google is just if she's talking to me and she's telling me where to go, I'm much happier. And I didn't like, so not that I do feel like it's helped me be on my phone a lot less, which I appreciate. I didn't like feeling like a schmuck because I am usually pretty quick to respond to people. But the last month or so since this phone stuff, I'm like, oh yeah, sorry. And then by the time I like get my phone charged up, I'm like, I don't know if this is even relevant anymore. I'm so mad at this phone. I don't even want to respond to anybody. So I did not live with it. I did not do the fire thing and suck it up and stick with my phone.
Yeah. Oh,